Would you make Ashu? Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I am so jazzed to be here. I'm so jazzed that you're fundraising. Congratulations. That is honorable and important work. And it's part of honoring the Sangha and taking care of the Sangha, doing what's in front of you, taking care of the practical needs that you have, taking care of the needs that you're going to have tomorrow. So, congratulations. Also, look at this strategic plan you've got. I love this strategic plan. And I love the fact that it's on the table. And as soon as you walk in, here's a copy of the strategic plan. So, congratulations on not just the Dharma work that you're doing here and the Dharma study, but all the other ways that you're working to be strong, to be viable, to be resilient, and to be here for future generations of people seeking the way. That is really great stuff. So how about a round of applause for yourselves? I would rather have a conversation with you today than give a talk and you be quiet. And then afterward, you have 10 or 15 minutes to make comments or ask questions. So if it's okay with you, let's just do more of an interactive conversation as we go, if that's all right. And we'll see where we land. Do you know the name of this talk? Anybody read your newsletter, your e-bulletin that went out? I'm testing you. We're going to test who opens it, who reads it, who
I knew
remembers.
you were going to be here.
Oh, all right.
I read that.
Okay, that's good. That's good. That's good. Radical Buddhism, Then and Now. It's the name of this talk. So there is a stereotype about Buddhism, what Buddhism looks like, what it sounds like, what it feels like, what Buddhist practitioners look like and sound like as they move through the world. And there's a big old stereotype about the Buddha himself, the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, and what he was like in terms of personality and temperament and the way he moved through the world. So that stereotype is fully baked in to popular culture. And what would that stereotype be? Or what would examples of that stereotype be?
Peaceful.
Peaceful. What else?
Aesthetic.
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 Ascetic.
To a degree.
To a degree. Okay. Stripped down. A little bit of suffering in there.
Somewhat serious.
Serious.
Nonviolent.
Nonviolent. So pacifist. What else?
Equanimity. Thomas,
Equanimity. Yes.
be sure to check the raised hands on your screen.
Oh my goodness. I'm not very good at raised hands. Hey, those of you who raise hands on screen, if you're okay with it, you can unmute and just weigh in. You don't need to raise your hand and wait for me to call on you. But having said that, Jessica, what you got?
Completely calm and always unruffled by anything going on.
Unflappable, perpetually unflappable, this permanent state of equanimity. Yeah, what else?
That makes me think of perfection.
Perfection. That somehow we've kind of sorted it all out and left behind all the routine mishigash of the world and have risen above it into a whole new, different plane of existence. What else?
Loving.
Loving that we're all loving.
Unconcerned about the state of the rest of the world.
Unconcerned about the state of the rest of the world, that
Like
we're
detached, I suppose.
detached, we're navel gazers, we don't really think much beyond that cushion, and we get up and leave and whatever. What else?
Oh, he would look strong.
That he would look strong, Shakyamuni would look strong.
Yes, because
Yes.
if you know where you're going, I mean, you're on your path, you wouldn't be, as someone said earlier, you wouldn't be distracted, you'd be unflappable. He'd be handsome.
Handsome. He was handsome. He was strong. He was resolute in his path and direction, forging ahead in an undistracted sort of way.
We're talking about the stereotype in popular culture,
Right?
right? Asian.
Asian! Asian! Right? Absolutely.
Very wise.
Wise.
Spending
Any?
all the time meditating.
I'm sorry?
Spending all the time meditating.
Hours upon hours upon hours, kind of sitting on cushions, meditating. No fun! No fun! Doesn't sound very fun, does it? Actually, when you think about some of these stereotypes, that doesn't sound very fun. Some sound all right. Anything else? You know, the truth is, who knows? Who knows? If we were to meet Shakyamuni, if we were to spend time in his presence, if we were part of the Sangha back in the day, if we had an opportunity to travel with him and sit with him and be instructed by him, who knows what that experience would have been like? Was he soft-spoken? Maybe. Was he introverted? I don't know. Maybe. Was he perpetually unflappable? Maybe. Was he serious all the time? Maybe. Did he ever get mad? I don't know. Maybe. Did he ever get frustrated and irritated and let it show? Maybe. When he got tickled, did he laugh loudly? Did he enjoy a good joke? Did he cut up? Did he have a silly side? Maybe. Was he extroverted? Did he love people? Did he get energy from being around other people? I don't know. Maybe. I don't know. However, even if he was unflappable, I'm just kind of struggling with this whole chair. I'm not feeling anxious. I'm just trying to get situated in this cushy chair with this cushion. I'm great. I'm great. Whatever he was like, and whatever the temperament of the broader Sangha was that he built and created, and there were people following him along the way through northeastern India, whatever their personality was, however loud or quiet, however peaceful or rambunctious they were, there were no question some of his teachings at the time that were, practically speaking, an affront to the political and religious and social order of the day. Nothing less than an affront. Now, was that affront done in an uber aggressive, uber mean-spirited sort of way? No, that's not my point. But even things that are quiet and soft and gentle and introverted and kind and loving can still be an affront to the political, social, and religious order of any day. And some of his teachings were absolutely that. And in a way, he was a big old radical. Now, when we use the word radical, other stereotypical images come up. When I say he was a big old radical, or you're a radical, or somebody else is a radical, what stereotypical images come up of radical?
Lighting things on fire.
Lighting things on fire. Taking a torch to stuff. What are the other
I get accused
images?
of this, so I know
You know this. You
that.
know it what you speak. Are there other stereotypical images that come up when I say radical or the word radical or they are radical? He was radical.
Protesters.
Protesters out in the street, marchers.
Extreme.
Extreme is a stereotype. We're talking about stereotypes. Loud.
kind of reactionary, and that they're not there for a reason. They're there just because they're acting out.
Just mad. Just mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. Kind of pounding of the table, kind of extreme, kind of loud, kind of forceful. Any other stereotypes about radical that come up?
Kind of fixated on their agenda.
Fixated on their agenda, sometimes having a hard time seeing the forest for the trees, sometimes not seeing the bigger picture, probably not real big on nuance, probably a little more black and white extremist sort of way.
Maybe brave.
Maybe what?
Brave.
Brave? Well, maybe another stereotype
To
of
be radical
radical.
in this world.
Is that it takes some bravery to be radical.
We get accused of being intolerant.
Intolerant, another stereotype. Well, I don't know about all those stereotypes about radicalism, particularly in the day of the Buddha. And I don't know if any of those things could accurately describe him at any time, or members of his sangha at any time, or leadership of his sangha at any time. I don't know. But I do know several things that he taught which were revolutionary. And one of the first things is to remember that northeastern India at the time of the Buddha, 2500 BC, 2500 years ago, 2600 years ago, was absolutely wholly, fully engaged in the caste system. And the system of caste was not just a social thing. It was a social thing, it was an economic thing, it was a political thing, and it was a religious thing. And the idea was that you were by birthright born into a particular caste, and there was a hierarchy, and there were folks at the top, the Brahmins, which were the priestly caste, and then sequentially lower castes, and that your position in the world, your access to things, the power and prestige that you have, the freedom with which you navigated the world, and people parted and gave you what you needed or gave you opportunity, it was everywhere, including in the prevailing religion of the day. And further, there was no fluidity among and between castes. If this is where you were born, good luck this life. And your job was to live that out and live that out as well as you could and hope that next time around, you'd come back in higher caste. But there was no fluidity at all. This was so intense, so baked in, so part and parcel, a part of life. It wasn't just what kind of job you had, it was who you talked to, it was who could be in your home, it's who you could touch physically. It was who you affiliated with, who you did business with. It was how you carried yourself through the street and how you expected other people to treat you as you walked to the street. It was that baked in. And one more time, fully supported by the religious order of the day. So here comes Shakyamuni in that context. And what does he say about caste? Or what does he do? Maybe more importantly than what he said or never said, or we think he said, what did he do around caste? It's not a rhetorical question. I'm asking you what he did. Weigh in. Tell me what he did.
I feel like he was indifferent to it. Like he
He
just
was indifferent to it. What else?
welcome to everybody.
He welcomed everybody. What else?
He
He violated it. He wasn't just indifferent to it. I understand the concept of being indifferent to it. And maybe this is just me and my projection, but I think he was way more than indifferent to it. I think he violated it. And he did it on purpose and he knew it. And he taught his followers to do the same thing. And he didn't just give a talk on Vulture's Peak about it. I mean, the way he populated his Sangha, the mendicants that joined him along the way, where those people came from, what their backgrounds were, what kind of work they had done previously, what their birthright or lineage was. It was a motley damn crew. Motley. And there were people affiliated with each other as peers that outside of his Sangha would never speak to each other. At the time, this was really radical stuff. There are two other things, although I'm sure the list is quite long, that rise to the surface when I think about him as a radical in his day. And there was another element besides caste. Any ideas or thoughts about when another element besides caste, which could be called class, I guess,
Gender.
gender. And like virtually every society in the world, or certainly most, through the eons, the role of women in Northeastern India, the role of women in caste, the role of women in Brahmanism, the role of women in the precursor to Hinduism. I mean, it was just replete with all the gender disparities and discrimination and exclusion as any other culture you've seen. And what did he do with that? He violated that. So there were monks, there were nuns, there were men lay people, there were women lay people, there were women with families, men with families, women and men without families, women and men who left their families. And there were women, and the idea that a woman could reach the same level of spiritual acumen, of spiritual freedom, of spiritual wisdom, of spiritual equanimity as a man was pretty darn radical at the time. A final thing is at the time, the Brahmins were at the top of the caste hierarchy, and they were the priestly caste. And it was very, very important for most people in most spiritual traditions at that time to rely on the Brahmin priesthood as their intercessor, as the maker of the sacrifices that were required or expected by the gods and by the different deities in order to curry favor, in order to cleanse, in order to do all of that. So there was a huge industry around not just Brahmin priests, but Brahmin priests and sacrifice, Brahmin priests and ritual. And the sacrifices were often animal sacrifices as well. So sentient beings that were also being sacrificed. So a huge emphasis on the important role that the Brahmin priests played in what was considered to be an incredibly important part of spiritual practice. And what did he do with that?
I mean, I know the answer based on what you said before you violated it, right?
Anybody else have an answer? Anybody else have an answer? Are you piecing together the puzzle?
related to the animal sacrifices. He said, "Do no harm to any living being." I know, I mean, assume what he said.
Yeah, when it came to those animal sacrifices, he was like, no. Which sounds like a little minor thing to us right here. It's like, eh. So, they want to sacrifice a horse. He said, please don't sacrifice the horse, whatever. But a big, big deal. He also said to the Brahmins, the idea that you're at the top of the heap, the idea that you're priestly and nobody else is, the idea that all the rest of you are reliant on you and dependent on you to be our intercessor and our the big convener of all the sacrifices, so that therefore we can be spiritual. No, not so much. Which must have pissed them off mightily. I can't imagine some of the gossip or the character assassination or the stuff that these folks were saying about him at the time.
A question. So,
Yeah.
did he say that directly or more indirectly by the teaching that every human being has Buddha nature within and can realize that?
My understanding, it was both. My understanding is it was certainly indirect, which was embedded in the broader teaching at large, but that this was not a spiritual leader who was shy, kind of speaking truth to power, so to speak, or calling people on their stuff when they came to visit him or call on him for instruction or guidance, and that his responses could be quite direct and quite clear as well. So my understanding was that it was kind of a combination.
So, do you think the agency that he had was because he was a prince? He was already at the one of the highest levels in society, being a prince.
Well, he was not a Brahmin himself. He was he one step down. So he didn't come from the highest caste. He came from a high caste, but not the highest. So this wasn't a Brahmin speaking to other Brahmins. This was somebody below them speaking up to them. And I think at that point, they could care if he was a prince. I think at this point, by the time he was out there violating the caste system and letting women in and diminishing the role of Brahmins in ritual sacrifices, and I mean, the fact he was a prince did not give him a pass in their eyes. So, all right. That's our history. That's our lineage. That's our root teacher. Quite a guy. Quite a person. Now let's fast forward to today. For different reasons, and in very different ways, there are quite a few teachings that you study here at Bright Ways Zen, and that I study at Dharma Rain Zen Center, and that the broader Sangha all across the world is studying in their sitting circles or their temples or their sanghas or whatever the case may be. And those teachings that you and I are learning and practicing in different ways for different reasons could be considered equally radical in today's social and cultural and political climate. Not on purpose, not because that's why they were birthed as teachings, but because they just are. Now let's think about the current social, cultural, political climate. And I want you to know it, when I say that, I don't just mean political, because I really do mean social and cultural. I think this is much bigger than just political. And I think it applies to those of us who are apolitical or don't participate in the political process. I think this is broader than that. We tend to think of it as political because we just went through this big election, but social, cultural, political, writ large. What is the prevailing ethos today around discourse today?
I mean, I think that's complicated because there's different
Sure.
approaches. There's very distinct approaches to that question.
But in a nutshell, what are the behaviors that are typically either expected or reinforced or applauded today?
I mean, I would say that there's a lot of wanting to make peace, reach across the aisle, achieve a status quo.
You think?
I do.
Okay. All right. What else?
I was going to say the opposite, but there's a lot of us versus them in the discourse.
Okay. So before we go further, multiple things can be true simultaneously. And just because this is true doesn't mean this and this and this and this and this aren't true too. But we happen to be going through a period where othering in lots of different forms is pretty prevalent, is pretty common, is almost expected, and is often reinforced when we do it. Anything else?
One thing that comes to mind, just that we were discussing about the sort of the Buddha's teaching of elevating all living beings, including animals and insects. We heard a great talk from a Sangha member about the Tenzo position, and he cited a story of the Buddha where he was crying for the insects that were being plowed in the field. And for myself, I see nowadays that still there's very little overall recognition for the equality of all earthlings and living beings on the planet in terms of how we produce meat for the greater, the larger population.
So the primacy of humans over and above all other sentient beings, it's another common part of the ethos and cultural, social, political fabric today. What else is common and out there and often reinforced or rewarded today?
Well, get a job, get married, don't rock the boat, have children, don't be poor, don't make waves.
So a certain level of conformity, a certain level of predictability, a certain level of don't rock the boat. How about certainty?
Worldwide, I think people don't feel heard and don't feel appreciated.
And what is it that, why is it that people aren't feeling heard or appreciated? What's happening, or how are we behaving, or what kinds of behaviors are being reinforced, expected, tolerated, whatever word you want to use, that leave some people feeling unheard, leave some people feeling disrespected?
I think there's isolation and hyper individualism that seem to come into everything, and that's reinforced by being online all the time for some people and sort of being in different bubbles and echo chambers.
Hyper individualism and isolation. Anything else?
Money runs everything.
Could you say that again, please? I didn't understand it.
Sorry. I think money, the billionaire class, have clout and control. The money controls.
Okay. Money and control. Anything else?
Being reactive.
Being reactive. Being quick to the point, quick to the counterpoint.
I think there's a lot of fear and suspicion out there too.
Fear and suspicion.
And I was going to comment that I think it goes back to the question you were trying to point to on certainty. We live in increasingly uncertain times for everyone on all fronts. And the more uncertainty there is, the more fear and insecurity, and people perhaps feel unheard because the ground under their feet feels increasingly uncertain and their needs aren't being taken care of.
So uncertainty, encountering uncertainty with what? Say
Certainty.
certainty. And what does that look like and feel like in today's climate? This certainty.
I'm right, you're wrong.
I'm right, you're wrong. What else does it look like?
I think
Conviction. What else does it look like?
partly too, it's a silencing of us.
I'm sorry?
A silencing
A
of
silencing. So I'm so right, you don't even need to bother. I am so certain. I am so clear. I am so convicted. Whatever you're thinking and feeling and experiencing, no need.
not listening.
Not listening. Absolutely. Anything else?
Thinking about social media and methods of display things and not the discomforting things in general, which makes it appear that everybody is great. And I'm not feeling so great, so I'm not in that circle.
So the idea that our public presentation of ourselves to each other in the world tends to skew toward the favorable, the positive, the enjoyable, masking some of what may really be going on with us, which is lots of consternation or suffering or fear or whatever. See, I think that today there are certain things that are rewarded, that are reinforced, and they're almost expected. And that doesn't mean every single person does them. That doesn't mean they're not exceptions along the way. But it feels to me like making the point and winning the argument is absolutely viewed as important and necessary and skillful and good. So if I can out-argue you, if I can get there first, if I can prove my point, if I can throw in a zinger or two, even that kind of tweaks you in the nose or punches you and makes fun of you in the process, I've scored. It feels to me also that certainty is highly valued, reinforced, fed, nurtured. This is a hard time to live in the gray. This is a hard time to have conversations that have lots of nuance in them. So, not just that I think something, but I think something. That sort of certainty. It feels to me like view and opinion and perspective are held in a very tight, this. So this is a cousin of certainty. So not just this is my view, this is my perspective, this is my opinion, this is my value, and I honor it and acknowledge it, but it's like this. Again, not all the time, not everybody, not constantly, not without exception. But that is part of the sea in which we're swimming and paddling on a daily basis. And then I think about a lot of the teachings that are offered at places like Bright Ways Inn. And I wonder how those teachings stack up next to some of this behavior, which has become social, cultural, and political norm. For example, no separate self. Now, there is no way, practically speaking, that I can move through the world as a person with a body and not have some sense of self. I mean, I just can't operate in the world. But on a spiritual level, the idea that there is no separate self, that there's not a me that is different from you. There's not a you that is fundamentally different from you. There's not a you that's fundamentally different. I am this and you are that, and we are different. Not quite the teaching. How about the teaching, do not indulge anger? How's that going these days?
You're not what?
Indulge anger is one of the Buddhist precepts. And the teaching isn't, don't feel anger. That's not the teaching. The teaching is not, do not ever experience anger. Not the teaching. The teaching is not, don't ever learn from your anger. Don't ever do anything with your anger. That is not the teaching. The teaching is, do not indulge anger, which is really different. How about the precept? Don't blame others and praise yourself. And that teaching is not, never feel good about yourself. Never acknowledge any good thing that you've done or any accomplishment. That's not the teaching. But the teaching is against moving through the world in this either or us, them, tribal driven sort of, I'm good, people like me are good, the way I think is good, my values are good, my opinions are good, and those are bad. Any other teachings that you can think of that in today's social and cultural and political climate seem to be kind of almost radical in a way? Out of step. Not part of the cultural norm.
Positive for reacting and just giving positive input as a response only.
So being careful about, so you're saying the teaching is which teaching? Is positivity, is that what you're suggesting? So I just want to make sure I'm tracking.
Yes.
Okay.
Positivity only, I guess.
Okay. Anybody else?
Honoring the gift not yet given.
Honoring the gift not yet given? In what way? Briefly.
If I can get away with taking something from someone that I should, and I'm perfectly entitled around it.
Okay. How about the teaching of right speech? You familiar with the teaching of right speech? Abstain from falsehood. Abstain from slander. You know the other two?
Haphazard talk.
Haphazard talk, sometimes called idle chatter. Yep.
Or gossip.
Idle chatter, gossip, slanderous speech. Abstaining from that talk. And then there's sometimes the 4-point scale, sometimes the 5-point scale, depending on what you read about kind of what is the filter for right speech. Is it true?
Timely.
Is it timely? Meaning, is it now? Is now the time? Not it's never time. Not that, you know, it will never be the right time, but is now the time? Is this right now the setting is now? Is it helpful? Sometimes that's translated into, is it beneficial? Is it useful? I mean, can anybody do anything with it? Or is it just kind of a venting, spewing thing that doesn't really offer much of anything to anybody, including the sayer of it? Is it offered in a spirit of goodwill? So am I doing it to one up you? Am I doing it to punish you? Am I doing it to prove you're bad and wrong and I'm not? Or am I doing it with the spirit or the intention of some sort of goodwill? And sometimes right speech means shut up. That was an interesting part of right speech. As somebody who's really chatty, I never grew up with the idea that right speech could mean no speech. Right speech could mean stop talking and don't say anything, which is hardly part of the social and cultural and political climate. Shutting up is not reinforced, not reinspected. Jumping in and winning the day, that's reinforced. anything else you can think of that in this climate feels like it's a little bit radical, a little bit out of step, not the most reinforced behavior these days?
I think the teaching of non-duality is not really in step with our culture of us and them, left and right.
So to Greg's point, the whole this or that, me or them, right or wrong, good or bad, this stark dual sense. I mean, that's just, I mean, Buddhism from the get-go just talk about violate, but attacks that whole concept from the get-go. I don't think the point of this is to either denigrate or diminish or poke fun of those of us who are responding to the current cultural and social and political climate with tremendous energy and tremendous commitment and tremendous determination. I don't think the point is to cast aspersions on that kind of response. I think the point is, aren't we made for moments like this too? Isn't our practice relevant, necessary for times like this too? No self, non-duality, right speech, compassion. Do those pertain only when things are calm? When we concur with what's happening, when we're in support of what's happening? Or do they also apply in times of war, be it political war, cultural war, social war? And if they do apply, how do they apply? And how do we be part of the real world today, which we're called to be, and also bring with us all of the things that we cultivate on that cushion and not just disregard them completely as soon as we enter the public sphere? What does that look like? How can I be angry and do that in a skillful way? How can I be convicted and move forth in that conviction and do that in a skillful way that is aligned with Buddhist teachings? How can I look at my nephew who I adore and say, I think you're a kook. The way you think and your worldview, I don't get it. I think you're off your rocker, some of what you believe. Can I even do it? Can I say that? How do I do that in a way that's aligned with Buddhist teaching?
I think that when situations like in the present discourse, it's really the precepts and the Eightfold Path are thrown into stark relief, and it really sharpens our understanding of what it means to not kill or not cultivate anger. My challenge, I think, is skillfully acting. Because, I have this reactive tendency to really think of this path as being so much better. It's helpful.
And when you say this path, you mean the Buddhist path or the
precepts?
The precepts. Well, isn't that how do we be Buddhist and how do we take all of this into the public sphere and do it in a non-dualistic kind of way that praises ourselves as Buddhists for how good we're doing, how right our view is, how much more evolved we are spiritually than some of those other people who have spiritual traditions that just seem to be whatever, stuck in the Stone Ages. I mean, how do we even do that?
Among all our differences, just assuming that everyone has positive intent and doesn't want to suffer. That's it.
How do we do that? How do we assume everybody has positive intent when we're looking at things and we hear things and we read things and we see things in it? I don't know what people's intent is because I can't see inside their heart. I can't see inside their mind. But it sure, if there's positive intent behind it, which there probably is in their view, it's hard for me to see it. But just because it's hard for me to see it doesn't mean it doesn't exist. Just because I may not agree with it doesn't mean there's not a logic to it that particular person has. You know, I remember when I came to Buddhism, I don't know, 23 years ago or something, probably like a lot of people, I didn't just have opinions. I had facts. And my opinions and my view and my perspective were not just good for me. You know who they were good for? You. You too. I didn't just hold things with conviction necessarily. I held things like this. And there was a self-righteousness in my perspective and my view and my opinion because I was studied. See, I had read things. I had probably read more things than other people have. This is all what I'm telling myself at the time, right? I had really thought, I'd been thoughtful, I'd pondered, I'd considered, I had really been more thoughtful than you. I was measured. I mean, I was informed. I had all the different views. I'd considered this view and this view more than you had. So that by the time I reached the opinion or the view or the perspective or my position on an issue or thing, it wasn't just, this is my view. It was with both fists tightly clenched that allowed for nothing externally to permeate it. And part of what my teacher challenged me on over and over and over is the idea that a view is great, normal, natural, part of being a human being who's thinking and thoughtful and engaged. And of course you have a view. Of course you have a position. Of course you have an opinion. Of course you are convicted. Of course it is the product of thought and consideration. Of course. So it isn't having a view is a bad thing. But is it possible to hold a view like this, where it's still honored, it's still acknowledged, I'm still holding it up, I'm still acting from this place, but it looks like it's being held more like this than this? And is it possible? Is it possible that any piece of my view, opinion, perspective, issue, position, you name it, is it possible that any of it anywhere could be wrong? Can you think about an opinion you had, a position that you held, a view or a perspective that you shared, and with which you experienced passion, not just a casual thing, but something you felt strongly about, that today you no longer feel, you no longer think, You no longer believe. You no longer hold true. You no longer abide by. Any of you?
I certainly can. I mean, as a younger person, I was a very, very vehement vegetarian, very strong in that. And everybody who ate meat was just a horrible creature. And I still kind of think that that's a better way to live, but I've relaxed considerably in my age about living in the real world.
There you go. And listen to how that was described. I still think that that's probably a better way. To me, that feels like a conviction and a view that's held, but it's held a little more respectfully than you idiots, you meat-eating idiots. What the hell are you thinking? What mental gymnastics are you going through to justify your evil and your stupidity and your dumbness and your... But it's still held. But do you just hear how it's held in a slightly different way? I used to think all kinds of things that I don't necessarily think today. I used to have all kinds of opinions and views and perspectives, that some of which I still do and some of which I don't. The other thing I learned and that my teacher helped me learn was there is not a correlation between the passion with which I hold a view and the rightness of that view. That was a shock to me. That was a total shock to me. I used to think, what do you mean? I mean, my gosh, you have no... I am so resolved. This goes so deep. This is so much a core value. It is so studied. It's just, I mean, how on earth could it not be thus? And I convinced myself that somehow there was a correlation. And there's not. There's not a correlation necessarily. So I don't know that I have any answers for anybody about anything, just like a good Zen Buddhist. I don't know what the hell we're doing and what comes next and who's doing it right and who's not doing it right and which ones of us are doing it the best and which ones of us should be learning from who. And I just know that Mahayana Buddhism, of which we are a part, is never, never, never just about us. It is never just about our own practice. We can sit over there by ourselves and stare at a wall and not say a word to the person on our left and right. We can come to Sesshin, we can come to Zazenkai, we can spend hours and hours with averted gaze, not making eye contact, not saying anything, swimming in whatever it is we're swimming on in the cushion, positive, negative, neutral, whatever. And even then, our practice is never just about us. That's just part of the fabric of Mahayanism, is that we're in this for everybody. What we're doing is for the merit of all sentient beings. That I can feel good about my practice. I can come to insights and understandings and awareness, and I can do this koan, and I can do this sutra study, and bully for me. But it's about you too. It's never not about you too, ever. And if that's the case, how do I take what I learn on that cushion and how do I step out into a social and cultural and political climate of the day? And how do I manifest that? And how do I do it in a skillful way and still be mad, still be afraid, still be... You name it. How do I do it? I don't know. So with that, I wish you all the best. And I am cheering you on from afar. So thank you so much for letting me be here today. You're welcome. Do we say a closing verse, or do you say a closing verse, or
do you know the abiding in the ephemeral world verse?
You know what? When I was driving here this morning in the car, I thought, "Oh crap! Do I know that verse by memory? I don't know it by memory. I know some of it."
All right, I will say it then.
Great.
Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha.
Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha, prajna, paramita.